So I've asked, since I don't have a, I'm a recipient of the press conference. At a press conference, I sit in the audience while and listen to the presenters. But Jackie has worked professionally on the side where she helps the interface between the scientists and the press. And I've called on her expertise in talking about dealing with the press. So this is Jackie Savani, and she has worked in public information both at Princeton and at UCSB. And she's going to start off by saying a few words, and then we hope to have some discussion and questions. So.
Let me see.
Right. So what I wanted to talk about is how to encourage publicity for your work. All of you, presumably, do research and make discoveries, and that research is funded by the government, the state government in the case of the University of California, but also, of course, the federal government agencies. And there's a case to be made for accountability, discussing your work with the public, or at least letting them know what it is that you're doing. So some of you, I'm sure, are modest and feel that you ought not to seek publicity, but in fact, there is this case for accountability and also educating people about science. Now, the usual way this is done is when you have an article on a significant piece of research on a discovery that you've made or that your group has made that's being published in a scientific journal that's refereed, especially Nature or Science, then you want to have your home institution do a press release. And the press release is timed for distribution to the press at the time that your article is published in the journal. Now, this is a somewhat artificial situation, but the media want to have what's called a news peg. They want to have a reason to be writing about your research. And Science and Nature have both cleverly monopolized the distribution in news and science by very strictly embargoing news and controlling its release. And so the news event, the news peg, is now the appearance of the article in any scientific publication, really. And what you want to do is, as soon as your article has been accepted, you want to consider, is this newsworthy? Should I be sharing this work with the public? And you have to understand that when you think about this question, one piece of the public that should be on your mind are your colleagues, not just in physics, but in chemistry, in the English department, because presumably the press release will run in the university's newspaper, and also its alumni magazine, and the student newspaper will pick it up. And so, in addition to the press, the local press, so that all sorts of people will have an idea of what it is that you do. And one thing that you need to think about, especially with alumni magazines and the institutions that you're all from, members of the press are also members of alumni bodies, and they get those alumni magazines, and they think about a lot of what publicity is a domino effect. So you need to get, you know, you need to encourage coverage in the alumni magazine, the student newspaper, these smaller outlets, and then other people read them and pick up the story, and then you'll see a kind of ramifying effect. Probably the most powerful news outlet for science is the New York Times Science section on Tuesday, because what they choose as the news is in fact what influences an awful lot of television coverage. For instance, television coverage of science is almost wholly derivative. Both television and radio, the assignment editors read the newspapers and do the stories. So you want to think about, is this piece of research really newsworthy? And you want to think about ways, when you're going to be, in, as soon as the article is accepted for publication, and the article can be about a piece of the research that represents a larger research program that you're going to publicize. And so that publication gives you the reason to have this press release done and have your work be written about, and also picked up in general by the media. Now, you probably the most important thing to do is to think ahead of time why it is that people who read the New York Times, Science Times should be reading about your research. Is it, does it merit coverage in that publication? And you have to be able to think about your research from that point of view so that when you go to talk to your press officer for science at your home institution, that you could insist on that reason. With engineering, which I've been doing for 4 years at Santa Barbara, it's really very easy because you always say, this will lead to this device, you know, the photonic circuit, the smaller whatever. And so you, with technology, it's a lot of condensed matter physics can be pegged to technology. And even if it's the most far-fetched application down the line, it really has to go in there so that people know why it is they're reading about this. For more fundamental physics like string theory, some condensed matter theory, astrophysics, it's the, oh gee whiz, isn't this world is so extraordinary and so incredible. That goes, and now all of that has to be what, you know, what the story is and why it's important in the first paragraph. Now I have a lot of scientists whom I've written stories about that they want their names up there, but your names are not that important, really. They belong down. Their proper names just clog the copy because they really belong, and the institutional affiliations, and who did what in this research, and what the credit should be, and all that, and who the funding, all these things that people are politically concerned about belong down in the press release. The news, the science, is the story, okay? And now another convention that you probably know about, but I'll just mention, is frequently that research is a matter of collaboration. If the collaborators are all members of an institution, then it's simple that that home institution should be doing the press release. But when the collaborators are from various institutions, the general rule of thumb is that the press release is done by the institution where the first author is. And then if you have an aggressive second author institution, like Caltech or MIT or the University of Chicago, they'll do a press release anyway. So you'll have two and three press releases out there, but the more press releases, the better, right? Now, the most important thing about this press release nowadays is that after it's, the reason this press release business is so important is you want to interview with your science writer. This is your way of controlling the story. You can say what it is that you do and why it's important, and then after the person, the science writer, does the press release, then they give it to you. And then you correct it so that the science is correctly explained, and you always have a document that is correct. Because frequently scientists complain that it's, you know, this pathetic explanation in the newspapers. And you can't actually, you don't have much control over journalists. They won't submit their copy to you for clearance. But this is where you can control it. And if you're concerned about, with someone like Barbara, who writing for Physics Today, who will want to call you up and say, who's going to want to talk to your colleagues about, well, what do you think of this piece of research? Is it really all it's cracked up to be? You know, what's wrong with it? She's going to do a more investigative point of view. And there's some of that at the New York Times. You might want to think about who ahead of time would comment on your research. And then you can say, oh, by the way, to the reporter, you know, this is all preparation. You can say to the reporter, oh, by the way, you know, you might like to talk to X about my research. He does something like this, or she does something like this, and she's at Caltech. And then you send an email off to that person and said, you know, I suggested that I suggested to so-and-so of the New York Times that they might want to talk to you, so that you're controlling the story a bit. And also, so that you've given your colleague an opportunity to think about what he or she wants to say critically about your work. Because it's very difficult when you're called on the spur of the moment and someone says, well, what do you think about such so-and-so's article? And you have, you know, sometimes you've seen it in preprint. But let's say you don't know what it's about, you're going to stumble on the phone. If you have prior, you know, some warning that's coming down the path, you can think of something to say. Okay, now, so now you have this person writing this press release and you're going to clear it. The other thing that you want to do is think about visuals that will go along with your story. And in many cases, this can be the visuals that are not used. You have visuals that are accompanying the article. And some of them you might, if the visuals that are used in the article cannot also be used with the press release, because they're copyrighted by the journal that's publishing the article. So you need to have some other visual representation. The simpler, the more vivid the color, the prettier, the better. But it should also, of course, explain your research. And it's nice if your institution has a scientific, someone who can do a representation. But many of you could do your own representation. You can actually have a graduate student or a postdoc do the that's what I see. Some of these graduate students and postdocs even do little film clips that we put online with the stories in engineering. You could,
if I might interrupt as an example, the NIST had in their press release, but not in their paper. I don't think it was in their paper. A picture from the overhead of pairs dancing in closed and open position as an example of pairing of electrons. So that was an example that was with the press release, but not with their paper.
Right. So all these, and those things are important, but it's this kind of staging activity for the successful routing of your publicity. Then the most important thing is that this press release be on Eureka Alert. This is the wire service, in effect, run by the online service for science stories run by the AAAS. And institutions such as Santa Barbara or Princeton or Caltech belong, and you post your press release with the embargo, and all science reporters in this country, and some of them abroad, subscribe to Eureka Alert and read every day Eureka Alert. And read every day what's on the news service. So there's a kind of competition of stories, you see. This is it. This is the repository of science stories, and all reporters subscribe to this. And this determines, you know, whether they're going to read, whether they're going to cover your research for the most part. And this is where you have a 75-word summary of your research. So you write the press release, and then you have a 75-word summary and a headline. And what reporters read is the 75-word summary and the headline. And then that will induce them to go to the story, and then they'll call you up and do it. Once they get to the press release, they're likely to do the story. So you really want to pay tremendous attention to that headline to make sure that it is scintillating when the draft of the press release is presented to you. Instead of worrying about some little comma or some, you know, I have people who worry terribly about these small details. With the press release, which is, you know, a very perishable vehicle, you really want to look at the headline and the first paragraph. This is what's really important.
Last question about this.
Yeah.
So news can be submitted to this site only through the institution.
Only through the institution.
Okay. And say, like University of Maryland, for example, supposedly University of Maryland. I'm not from Princeton.
Yeah.
I'm from Maryland.
Okay,
so
but
who institution subscribes to it or something? I'm a member of it.
I would assume, and you have a right.
Okay, so then I should go to the officer at University of Maryland and ask the officer, information officer, whatever it is.
Right, and they do the press release, and they also would post this press release on Eureka Alert. And if it's not posted on Eureka Alert, then I mean, this is it. That's all you have to do nowadays.
Okay. They charge?
Oh yeah. This is quite a business.
How much?
Just for engineering was an $1,100 subscription a year. I posted my press releases on engineering. They charge between $100 and $150 per release, or you can buy a subscription of $1,100 a year. And I did enough stories that it was worth it. You also post awards and money allotment stories. These minor stories. That's another.
But the reporters looking at it can segregate, and they can choose not to look at. I choose not to look at the award stories.
Right.
I just look at the news.
And it's very elaborate. There are, when you have a press release, you pick 10 categories that you're going to have in the search engine: nanoscience, microelectrical MEMS, that kind of thing. So the people who have those different beats go after the stories and in their topic, like chemistry or whatever. Okay, now after you've done the press release, as I said, the institution itself will be running this in its own publications, and this is good for you because your colleagues see what you do. But what you want to do is also make sure that the press release gets in the hand of the funding agency. Because funding agencies like to have press releases because they in effect explain what it is that the funding agency is supporting in plain language, which they can use when they talk to Congress or when they talk to congressional aides.
I might add that funding agencies also have their own press releases that go
you
to
bet.
Reporters.
That's
I periodically get things from National Science Foundation highlighting research that they have sponsored.
Would the NSF subscribe to this and survey this on a regular daily basis?
The NSF puts out press releases.
Where did they get the information from?
Let's say I had a woman who was a chemist here called Allison Butler, and the head of the chemistry, one of the principal program officers in the chemistry division at the NSF called me, and he said they were doing a press release and he'd appreciate it if I also did one.
Okay.
And so I would assume, I know I posted my press release on Eureka Alert, but I also post my link to the NSF press release, and the NSF press release posts a link to my press release. So that, you have all of this.
There was a lot of publicity about this discovery of this crater off northern Australia. And that was from Santa Barbara. It got in the New York Times, and you probably weren't involved.
It was on NPR.
It got a lot of publicity about these extensions.
One of the government agencies, maybe it was NSF, I have a press release from them about that. Yeah.
Probably NASA.
Yeah. Oh. Well, they are the premier publicity machine.
Yeah,
one of the.
I
mean, they're worthy of Madison Avenue, NASA. They're spectacular press releases, NASA, because they need to get all that money all the time
feed the beast.
And in order to get the money, they need to have massive publicity for their successes, and so they've got an incredible publicity machine. But the NSF less so, of course. But they also put out press releases. And but the point is that you want to also give your institution's press release and maybe even a copy of the university's alumni magazine to people at the NSF. That's a kind of good accountability for them because they can then use those materials in their own presentations. Okay, now I did indicate that television is derivative. That for the most part, when I was at Princeton, I interacted with the science editor at CNN frequently. And what CNN would do is send a truck to Princeton, and they would call me ahead of time and say, we want 3 or 4 science stories. You give us 5 or 6, and we'll pick the 3 most visual. So they were not pegged to news. The economics of the business was such that they would send the truck there and they would expect 3 or 4 stories. And so, that's the way television is done. Also, though, with technology, you know, where my engineering press releases were really picked up was on the web. There are all these technology magazines on the web. I'd put my post, my press release on Eureka Alert, and I tracked, I did one press release on a photonic circuit, and 70 web magazines, newsletters picked up, venture cap, you know, all these investment types, all these, there's a tremendous market, but that's the online market for that kind of technology. That's a market for condensed matter physics stories, is that technology online route. Okay.
How do you get access to these online?
Again, Eureka Alert. They do, in fact, what they do is they take, you know, I'm very surprised to discover, I'll see my press release verbatim, the one I did that's been dropped into a magazine, an online magazine, no credit for me or anything, but they just wholesale take the thing. That's why you want to spend a fair amount of time doing a decent press release in the first place. Now, I also wanted to say, let's say you don't have especially good science writing at your home institution. Then what you do is you can try to get a press release done through the American AIP, American Institute for Physics, does press releases. The funding agency, as I said, does press releases. And also your collaborator's institution might do press releases.
I wouldn't call it press release, but the American Institute of Physics has at least two people who weekly look through all the publications, Science, Nature, PNAS, physical review letters, and so forth. And they write summaries of the things that they think are of most interest to the general reporter. But you could, I don't know if they are amenable to being contacted by.
Well, I know scientists who have tried when they're disappointed with their home institutions. They really try to work that angle too to get publicity. Now, another, so this is all research publication pegged reporting. Also, you can encourage someone in your alumni magazine or your university newspaper to write a pleasant feature about you and your work. And again, that's a different way of getting picked up. This is a feature that talks more about you. By a feature, I mean something that isn't just hard news, but talks about you know, what kind of person you are. So the local newspaper did a feature on David and talked about how many cigars he smoked in his car. That, you know, that kind of human interest with you know, the cigar.
The owner of the cigar store, we saw him pass the exam.
Yes.
You're a poster child.
So that kind of story, you know, that's a kind of color story that local reporters handle very well. You can encourage that kind of story in alumni and in all these more local whenever you have a chance to do that. I realize that many of you are too modest to want to do this, but you know, it's really worth it to try to get this science.
Might get a few boxes of cigars.
Now, the other thing that I'd like to suggest, especially for the condensed matter people, is that when something happens, like there's an earthquake, or a bridge collapses, or something like that, or I know I tried this with the Columbia.
Even a new superconductor discovered that has nothing to do with your work.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Send an email to your press office, either to the head of the news office or to the science writer, and say, oh, by the way, I'd be happy to talk to the press about this, because I guarantee you that they're going to get lots of calls and for an expert. They need, you know, they need experts. There's also an online service called ProfNet, and they it's a service that solicits experts, that if you have a really good news office, they will try to get their experts matched to the news solicitations on ProfNet.
The same office I mentioned earlier, Public Information at the American Institute of Physics, they like to have a stable of an expert,
right,
who can be consulted on specific issues. So they like to know about you.
And it's just such a wonderful thing. If you just, oh, by the way, in case somebody wants an expert on, use plain language on bridge collapses, earthquakes, superconductors, something that the words that the media can deal with and not too technical or specialized vocabulary. This is a good way of self-identifying yourself. Jim Langer, for instance, gets lots of is quoted frequently as an expert on earthquakes, and California is a good place to be into that kind of condensed matter theory. Now, I wanted to say just a couple more things about awards and money. Unless it's a Nobel Prize, in fact, the LA Times only does Nobel Prizes. It doesn't do any other awards. So it may be the so-and-so such-and-such prize of the American Physical Society. Well, you know, that's maybe a two-paragraph or two-sentence story in the university's newspaper. Awards and money. I had a faculty member, he was so angry at me, he got a $5 million grant, he wanted a press release. And I said, you have to do something with the money, and then I can report on what you do, but I can't report on the fact that you got this money, because the newspaper doesn't care about it. He didn't believe me, but I'll just say that. Finally, I just want to say a word about misconduct. In issues of misconduct, which are issues of research fraud, you're sexually harassing a graduate student, all those kinds of issues, you want to stay away from the press. You want to
stay away from me.
Yeah, it's really not a good idea to talk about this. This is what you hire the lawyer for, and you refer the press to the lawyer, and you let them say some inane thing.
Lawyerly stuff.
In your, pardon?
Lawyerly stuff.
Yeah, that isn't quotable, which is what they'll do. That's just an aside. It may be that none of you need to know this, but it might be helpful for a colleague at some point. You can say, oh, I think that you probably should keep your mouth shut. Because it's just a very slippery slope.
Do you have any stories?
I do, but... Now, finally, now that I'm talking about this kind of issue, let me just say in closing that of all the media in my experience, the most tricky one to deal with is radio. Because a print reporter, you can always say to your colleague, I didn't really say that, they misquoted me. On television, there's your body language. You know, they need to show you when you're saying whatever it is you're saying. But on radio, they can take some little sound bite and they can play it, and you can say the most ridiculous things. So of all the media, if you're ever in one of these misconduct or ever in anything that's difficult, you have to be most careful about media, about radio.
They record things,
but then they just take what they want. And so it's in your own words, but it's a half of a sentence, and it doesn't have the context that you provided.
Can they do things like Photoshop and take a lot of individual words you say? I mean, that they could do it, but I guess
they don't.
Brutal.
Yeah, they don't. And of course, you know, I once had the chair of the Princeton Math Department on a talk radio, you know, one of these scurrilous talk radio. He did wonderfully because he loved to argue and so forth and so on. But, you know, you really have to be a very assured person to manage those kinds of people, and I would stay away from that kind of thing as well. Yeah, but usually your voice is contained with your body language, and your body language mitigates to some extent what it is that you're saying. I'm just saying from my experience, when I've been really nailed, because I was the apologist for Princeton University, that was my job, where I would really be nailed was on radio. I would just be horrified at the things that I seemed to be saying on radio. Much worse so than on television.
But you can't just refuse to be on radio.
No, I couldn't. That was my job. I hated it. And no. What I did is I would write it down. Oh, this is maybe in closing what I should say. You have to decide what it is that you want to say. And no matter what they say to you, what question, you have to keep saying what it is that you want to say. Politicians do this. And this is very important.
Do you find that most reporters abide by the request? I don't want to be quoted. I give you comments for background only. You know, if any of us said something, if any of these people said something at the beginning of the interview, say, I'm giving you information for attribution only, I don't want to be quoted, you think that there were some reporters who could not be trusted on that?
Obviously, I can't. Yeah, but you're very special. I mean,
no,
because
I know.
It's
we're
today.
In a unique position because we have time to be checked, but I just wondered whether you found that. I mean, I've come across reporters who said, there's one fellow who said, you know, they blew out of context what I had said, and I later talked to that reporter, and she said, well, I have it on tape. He actually said that, and she was so gleeful. I think she knew it hadn't really been what he wanted to say, but she had it on tape, and
right,
she felt she was entitled to print it.
You bet.
So you're saying if you have something really delicate, you have to...
Yeah, I think that for you, it comes in commenting on your colleague's work. You want to be extremely judicious. You don't want to say anything snide. For sure you'll see that in print, even if you... You know, because people like that needle. That kind of needling comment makes a good story. Some sort of, forgive me, smart-ass remark, oh boy, that's what they're going to use. And you don't want, and the amount of damage this would do with your colleagues isn't worth it. The other damage I see is press releases. I see assistant professors who, at Princeton, I used to try to be very careful about this. You'd see people who were gunning for tenure, and they would want publicity for their work, and they would want to make overclaims, and I would want to try to protect them from themselves with respect to their colleagues.
There's one case, this stuff that Barbara mentioned, the Jilla press release, where they talked about, quote unquote, a new state of matter. There have been half a dozen new states of matter in the last 10 years, and this is getting a bit ridiculous, 20 years. And I think say this was clearly,
yet
in
another
my view,
new
not a new state of matter compared to, say, the quantum Hall effect, which I think was a new state of matter.
But see, you could say that. From my point of view, this isn't a new state of matter the way the quantum Hall effect was.
You're obviously very careful about trying to keep the assertions under control, but it's just a little weird in this case. I don't know whether it was the Jilla publicity office or what.
I've heard that there was a lot of pressure from the Jilla publicity office to hype that work. I don't know what kind of pressure they in turn were under for that at that time. But it was an example, I believe, of work being overly hyped. There was good work there,
mm-hmm.
but the statements being made were a little over the top.
Do you mean to imply that even if a reporter tells you this is off the record, you should not trust him?
I, as Princeton's press officer, I was this. That was my job. I never trusted reporters.
Were there
never,
some
never
that?
What?
I'm. It's just what I learned.
Could you have made a list and say these people can be trusted? And these, I mean, from your experience, no. You can't trust me.
What about the New York Times? I mean, they seem to be even never trust any journalist.
I'm saying if you say it, you expect to see it in print attributed to you.
Even if he told you before, these are the
reasons. Because of that,
this is what I would do.
No, but I have
this is how you can get into trouble. And I'm saying that it isn't, in my experience, it isn't worth the amount of trouble it can have, especially when you're asked to comment on your colleague's work.
No, it's consistent with my viewpoints. It was okay. I got my funding, and it's very mad at me. That was that. And I did say it.
Now, can I ask you a question? Sometimes, really, they do very wrongly, very badly. I mean,
yes.
They misrepresent what you have done, etc. I could give you one or two anecdotes which are absolutely amazing.
Appalling, I know.
When this happens, would you recommend to try to get
a retraction?
A retraction, or rather shut up and let it just cool down? What would be your opinion?
I would do two instead of one.
That is?
I would not ask for a retraction. What you would do is to make sure that your press office, again, knows that this is incorrect,
okay,
so that other people who follow up on that story get the right story.
Okay.
But to try to, I had a mathematician at Princeton try to force, it was the traveling salesman problem in the New York Times. He tried, the reporter got it all confused, and he went after her, and he wanted a correction on that, and she wouldn't do it. And so finally, he had her expelled from the American Association of Science Writers over this. I mean, he made such a to-do over this. Well, that meant that they were hesitant to cover mathematicians at Princeton for fear that they would, you know, incur this kind of ordeal. These very precise people. I also had another thing with the math department was that Science magazine had some numbers wrong on a chart. And the math department insisted that I get those numbers corrected. And so I began about, you know, a year-long campaign of letter writing to get those numbers corrected. And they finally corrected the numbers. And when Science magazine did that, they also did an article on a woman, assistant professor who didn't get tenure in the math department, and it was one of these exposés that they printed along with, they get you. Okay. This is a true story.
Well, the chart was about discrimination.
Yeah, it was about, yeah.
Do you want a story about how they get you? I was once called by a journalist, we wanted to talk to me about something, a result which had been obtained but not yet accepted in Israel.
Okay, yes.
I told them, no, I will not talk to you before it is refereed and accepted. And the guy told me, no, but you know, it's timely, we want to do it this week, it's a weekly magazine, it's a Nouvel Observateur in France, we want to do it immediately, it's timely, or either this week or never. And I answered on the phone, it doesn't matter. It's not so important, you know. Listen to what happened. Next week,
I know what
there
happened.
Was a paper with my photograph they got from somewhere, and below, it's not so important. This true story. In Le Nouvel Observateur.
This is a wonderful example of
and
what
I
I'm saying.
I decided to follow your advice, that is to say, to just shut up and have no reaction.
Yeah, because then it dies. But the more you go on with it, the worse it can get. It's one of these, you try to assess the path of least damage after the initial damage, and it's usually to let everybody forget about it.
I think there was a question.
Dealing with your own newspaper, home institution, the paper newspaper covering your home institution, should you just follow the same procedure, or do you recommend contacting them directly under any circumstances?
You mean if they've reported you wrong?
No, if you say you have some new discovery, and you could do a press release, and perhaps no one picks it up, but maybe you would like to have coverage, you know, in your own city or something.
Okay, let's say, and this happened to me at Princeton all the time because I had so many people who did so many newsworthy things. You can only do press releases about some of them. But it's very important for the science writer to know that you have done this. Because I would get phone calls from all kinds of reporters, and they would say, okay, you know, what's going on at your institution? So a lot of times I would just tell them, and then they would come and interview you. And that's more difficult because you don't have the priming paper.
Right.
But as long as you've notified the press office, then they can feed that to the reporters when they call wanting news. I mean, these guys have to do their stories.
You mentioned New York Times, right? So is there a way to directly contact them? Because this is pretty long way out of the institution, blah, blah, blah.
What's your home institution?
Maryland, University of Maryland. And put it this way, the work I'm thinking about is interdisciplinary. So I look at the categories, Eureka, et cetera. You know, it doesn't fall into a category. I mean, it's a different category. So
yeah, but
I'm not even sure who would.
Maybe we could do this as an example. What's the work?
Well, we spent a couple hours with Barbara Levin discussing this.
it's applying statistical models to economic data.
Applying statistical physics to economics.
That's not a hard sale.
Uh-huh.
See, that's the kind of thing that. There's a guy called John Markoff, Markoff. He's at the New York Times office in So if you give me if you give me your email at the end of this, I'll give you a way of reaching him, and you can send an email to him and describe this work. He's one of these people who is a bridge person between the business pages of the New York Times, the technology, and the Science Times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that story belongs.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But you have to have real findings.
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course.
Okay. Okay. And you would write an email to him and describe them.
Right.
For his consideration. The other paper that would really like that is the Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal, yes.
Yeah.
So who is
I don't know offhand anymore.
Put it this way, for example, one of my work, Australian Journal, a financial, it's called the Australian Financial Review, which is like Wall Street in Australia.
They did it.
Journalists wrote a paper, wrote an article, wrote a column about my work.
Okay, then you take that and send it to them.
Uh-huh, okay.
A little
but
paragraph.
But if you say Wall Street Journal, I have no idea who is them, and Wall Street Journal have no idea about whom I should send them.
Yeah, but. Well, you know, what I would do if I had that story is I would go to the journal online, which is, alas, you have to have a subscription for. You have to pay for that one. It's not like the New York Times and the LA Times, which are free. But then you see who does what story, and you send it to that reporter. It's another way of doing it.
I have a question about two different aspects of things that you said. One is about the exaggerated claims. You alluded to that. And professional misconduct is, I mean, some of the exact claims I read about are really professional misconduct. I mean, because I know the work, and the claims I see are just unbelievable. I mean, I know the work very well. In a few cases, I refereed the work. And then I see claims in you know, various places which are so exaggerated. Can that even lead to professional misconduct?
Well, you know, what about this Schoen case?
Well, Schoen was making up data, so.
Yeah. So that wasn't an exaggeration. That was a that was outright fraud. Yeah.
No, this is just
claiming something will revolutionize technology. You know, where if you talk to any of the experts, people will refer to the work, say it's good science.
But you said that you can even give a far-fetched example.
Yeah, you have to do that. I'm so sorry. You know, for instance, the newspaper. The newspaper. I like to try to get science stories in USA Today because it's a national newspaper, and the only way you're going to do it is with that kind of hype.
But this is actually a question for both you and the other people here. I think that you pay a price, am I right? You may end up getting your work better known among the public. But I think your colleagues would
put
you down a notch.
Yes.
I think
you know,
you
that's the Carl Sagan effect, in a
right.
way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why do you call it the Carl Sagan?
I call it the Carl Sagan effect because he, in fact, is the premier publicist of science ever,
yeah.
I think.
Yes.
Brian Greene aside,
yeah.
Carl really has the... and I think he paid a price for that in that his colleagues then tended to look down on him for that.
He wasn't a serious scientist.
Yeah, he had difficulty getting into the National Academy. Weren't there?
Yes, I think that's right.
I mean,
that's a slightly different effect because he was not just hyping his own work. He was popularizing all science and spending a lot of time doing it.
Yes.
I think we're talking more about someone who just consistently overstates his own work.
In the case of Sagan, there was the nuclear winter hypothesis.
Oh, yes.
No, that was overstated.
That was overstated and that came back to haunt them.
Right.
Yeah, see, my whole approach to being a press officer was to always try to tell the truth, because I would have all these consequences down the line if I didn't do it.
Besides research and individual portraits you mentioned, sometimes I see
experts
about workshops. For example, at Aspen, there was a workshop.
Yes,
on string.
Yes, that was really unusual. Uh-huh. I was stunned when I read that article. But also Casey Cole. I mean, that was in the New York Times and the LA Times. Basically, these are really, you know, the people that these science writers are some of the brightest people at these papers, and they go to the meetings. They're invited to these meetings, and they go to the talks and they'll report. And when we went to a meeting at Case. What was that? The cosmology conference at Case, and who is who's that guy? Who's the chair of physics?
Lawrence Krauss.
Yes, and he's brilliant at publicity. Honestly, I mean, wow. And
what?
You know,
physics of Star Trek. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And he marched. He had. This is in Cleveland. I mean, he had the Dallas Morning News there. He turned out the press. It was really quite remarkable because of his connections via the Star Trek material.
No, because he had promised them. What he did was promise them news.
And then
what?
News.
Promised them that there would be some observers who would come to this meeting and announce new results.
And they did not.
They weren't. So what Dennis Overby did is David and Steve Weinberg got into it on the anthropic principle, and Dennis Overby turned around and wrote an article on that. So there, you know, you can and that's wonderful if reporters come to these events, and they see your excitement, they'll do the story. But that's the real thing. That's not this artificial effort. So,
I wondered if Tony wanted to say a few words about
fame.
About your experience as probably the focal point of many reporters.
I think the only thing I can contribute is some of a cautionary tone. Of course, after the Nobel Prize has been announced, I got a lot of requests for interviews and so forth. And one of the requests I got within a few days of the announcement was from one of our local television channels. And this was in fact a reporter. I knew it since I saw it on our local television. And she said she'd like to come and interview me about the prize and the work I've done and so forth. And fine. So I set aside half an hour for her to interview me. And indeed, the interview did take something of the order of half an hour, including, I guess, posing me for shots, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, it went something like this. She started off by asking, a couple of sort of slightly desultory questions about the actual research I'd done, which I tried to answer. And then she said, well, you have actually, how long would you say it took you to actually do this research, which the Nobel Committee now recognized? So I thought about it, and I sort of gave her the figures, you know, this is where I started working on helium, and roughly this is where I did a bit of work that they'd recognized and so forth. But she didn't seem terribly interested in this, and she, then she went on to what clearly was her real agenda in this interview. She said, now, well, you know that Governor Edgar, ex-governor, has been nominated for the Nobel Prize. And the Nobel Peace Prize. He's the one who, that's right, he recently been nominated, I mean, he'd been nominated because he commuted the death sentences.
Right.
On death row, and so forth. And so she said, I said, yeah, I know about that. And she said, well, don't you think it's a bit unfair that someone who's just done something in his last year in office should be. When all this took sort of the order of half an hour in total. When the result finally came out on our local evening news, they had, I think, about 15 seconds worth. They interviewed the other, Paul Hilbert, that was another Nobel Prize winner this year, from Illinois. And so they had his brief comments, and they had about 15 seconds on my comments. I have to say they did quote me accurately and not out of context, but that was it. I mean, it was absolutely nothing from the other 25 minutes.
Was that the right example? But they just showed the part about the death sentence, about the governor?
Yeah. Oh, they did show that part.
Yeah.
They sort of had the usual introduction about, this is what Nobel Prize winners probably think about it.
See, I think that the danger, now that you brought the subject up, what we're looking at is comments about defense-funded research. If those of you who are funded by DARPA or the Army Research Office or the Navy somehow, I think that you can expect difficult questions from reporters because of the war. Because the news is political, and so reporters, most of the reporters, especially on television stations, boy, do they not have any idea why you want
to ask Rumsfeld difficult questions.
That's true, though, isn't it? Yeah. And they can't deal with physics. I mean, when Herb Kroemer won this Nobel Prize in physics, he was on McNeil Lair. Oh, it was amazing, their attempt. And this is a very serious television, they wanted to understand what he won it for. And he couldn't, he it sounded as if he had lapsed into a foreign language when he began to explain heterojunctions and semiconductors. You know, a semiconductor, I mean, people don't know what a semiconductor is. So, So that's why it goes like that. To the political, which is what the especially television reporters, they don't have a science background. That's what they know about to do.
Would you advise someone in a case you're being interviewed and the question veers off into something political? Can you just simply say to the reporter, "I'm not prepared to comment on anything except my own work"?
Yes, you can say that. Or, you see, that's why what you say is what can be taped, is what can go on air. Mm-hmm. And so if you say nothing, they can't run anything. See, because they're doing 25 minutes.
That's the advice she gives, because I have had several problems with journalists.
Say nothing.
You are 100% true. But what you they cannot do, quote something you didn't say.
But what you can do, and I learned to do a bit, and politicians do this brilliantly. The smart ones. I think Mario Cuomo invented it. Was to essentially answer a question you don't want to talk about with, almost say, what you really wanted to ask me was, or do, or ask,
right.
or ask
you,
or perhaps what you really meant was, ask a question. Do I want to do it? Do I want to do it? And you can, and politicians now have learned to do this. And good politicians, in interviews,
you say what it is that you want to say.
Ask themselves questions, one after the other.
Right.
Do I want us to withdraw from Vietnam now? Yes. Do I want us to be there? Do I want to go on and on? You can conduct your own interview. And the reporters, actually, some
being interviewed sometimes by science reporters who aren't so sure of themselves. No, they appreciate that. You're mm-hmm. running the interview for them. Mm-hmm. So you could probably do it that way. You could have said, maybe what you really wanted to ask me was, why is helium 3?
No, this I have
learned.
The president of my institution 4 or 5 years ago was asked a series of hypothetical questions that had to do with did he think that the outcome was influenced by what he'd done, and instead of just, his answer was, I just don't know. And I thought that was a perfect answer because he didn't hypothesize over anything, and nobody can fault him for saying that.
Mm-hmm. Although, to have the president of an institution with a soundbite, I just don't know.
Well, you see,
you say nothing.
Yeah, this was the outcome.
No,
really?
This was
Stanford?
This was Casper.
Oh,
this
is Casper.
Yeah. Stanford. Yeah. Garrett Casper was very good with the press.
Yeah, he's terrific.
And I liked when he was asked, are you stepping down because of embarrassment over the failed merger with the medical school at UCSF? And he took out his little constitution because he's a constitutional lawyer. And he turned to the page and it says here, the President of the United States is restricted 8 years. I think that's good enough for the President of Stanford.
See,
I don't
know. What?
That was a brilliant solution to a public question.
That is fantastic.
No, he's very sharp. That was good. It was perfect.
No, but I mean, if he had, that would have been just to illustrate what you said early on, is that you think about ahead of time the kinds of questions that you might be asked. And what kind of answers you want to make, and really learn them, maybe write them down and have that prepared to say.
Right. See, what I'm saying is with cadets matter physicists or whatever, I think you have to be very careful about defense research right now, because that could turn the environment is very ambivalent with respect to this war, and to be in, we don't, you know, we could have a reprise of the Vietnam War research on campus and, you know, all of that sort of thing. I worry about that with the Center for Biotechnologies that's just been established here, and I was very careful when we made that announcement, because I think that may come again. Universities involved in defense research, maybe not. But you just want to be careful. The other thing is animals, which is not relevant to any of you. But if you do research on cats or dogs, you don't want any publicity whatsoever. Period. None. Even rats, I think.
You don't know it, but there is a laboratory on this campus.
Oh,
which has locked doors. It is very, there's no
it's
an incredible place to get in there.
I was once. Talk about it anymore.
As somebody who is extremely well funded by Defense Department, I get $1 million from Defense Department to say we are materialists. I don't quite understand
really?
The point. Yeah, I don't quite understand the point. David Oshan gets much more. So you know, so
yeah.
The example is bigger than me. But I don't quite understand your point, because all the research that I do from supported by
you. You're too young to remember the era.
Sure, no. But I'm trying to understand. No,
at that time,
yes.
There was, it fed in, it was partly Vietnam.
It was classified research. Should be funded by NSF, but NSF will give me $60,000.
Right.
And WINAR and DARPA and ARDA, National Security Agency, gives me. They give me $600,000, so of course I don't go to NSF. It's absolutely NSF research. It's an absolute open research. In fact, the reporting requirement is not NSF.
Right.
The proposal is just half a page.
But look, here, let me give you.
When I first came to Princeton, you were hired in physics, theoretical physics supported by ONR, by the Navy, which was one of the Navy, was the best by the Navy magazine. But, and it had no place, but then there was a big reaction. And that was all removed.
That's Mansfield Amendment. That's Mansfield Amendment. I mean, you know, that's.
No, but what I'm just saying is you want to be low key.
The Defense Department was not going to support anything that wasn't really relevant to their goal. Now, you get all Jackie was saying was that the atmosphere against the war could turn so that you would be tarred with
It must be relevant.
Russia being relevant to their goals.
Quantum computing, is it relevant or is it not relevant?
Well, you know, with David Absalom, it was the center, it's called CNID, the Center for Nanoscience Initiative in Defense. And this is to funnel defense. It's to funnel research findings in nanotechnology to defense contractors. Okay, that's what that grant is for. And so David and I talked about this, and we issued the press release when the students had left campus, so it wouldn't be picked up in the student newspaper. We actually thought about a strategy with respect to the release of that news.
So you think this could be a problem? This is a point David is making. This could be a problem, more than a problem of
water. You know, it's my job to tell him, look, you know, we don't want students on this campus picketing your office, do we? No. So you just, you know, you anticipate that kind of thing, and you just don't. What I'm saying is that you don't wave a flag, realizing that that's a tricky environment. Now, another example is when we gave the media availability for this Institute for Collaborative Biotechnologies, funded by the Army Research Office here. So we had this lovely press conference, and we had all kinds of scientific material. And I turned around, and one of the reporters cornered Henry Yang on camera. I turned around, the microphone was in his face, about what's he doing, you know, what's he doing being the chancellor of an institution that is backing research for, you know, bioweapons that will harm people. You know, that's what that reporter went for. That's like your Nobel Prize. I mean, they go for that trap. And what I'm just saying is to be aware of that and to be low key. If you're giving a talk, a public talk about your research, you don't need to mention the fact that you're funded, you know, heavily by the Defense Department.
No, the point is that any defense research is now, there could be open source on it because there is just a negative feedback.
We're just maybe entering that kind of environment, and so now's the time to be careful that you don't wave a red flag. Let them. Yes.
It seems to me that rather than sort of trying to keep it completely out of range, it would be perhaps a better strategy for those who do receive this kind of funding to think out carefully why they believe it's okay to receive it.
Indeed, although I'd hate to get into a public, I mean, then you're a spokesperson for funding. I mean, those issues are best, unless you really mean to be a spokesperson for Defense Department funding of research. And so then you're on the circuit and you get lots of calls and, you know, you become the spokesperson for that issue. You want to steer clear of it.
One would want to defend it, as it were, in general, but presumably one would want to defend it as it affects one's own research. And so I would have thought that, I don't get any defense money, but I would have thought that.
So you would be an ideal person. A, you're a person of enormous stature, and you have a lovely, gentle, you know, body language and presence, and you would be just the kind of person I would want to put on camera to defend this.
What do you call a gentle
person? See, when you see, but this television is all body, okay? The words hardly mean anything. See, so he has this lovely, you know, and his delicate bones, and a very upper class English accent. I don't know if it is, but that's what it sounds like to an American. And you know, and a very careful, gentle way of speaking, rather than a more aggressive kind of you. So you would be a very, you know, your body language would be the defense. And see, with someone like Henry Yang, poor Henry Yang, there he is, he got nervous. Oh boy, you know, and his minder came and said to me, you've got to do something about this. And so, you know, I have to do some awkward thing to break off the interview so that it can't be used.
Okay.
like sort of walk in front of the camera. Because it's all such a manufactured reality, and you know, your story about the Peace Prize for the governor is perfect. That didn't belong at all in your, I mean, that, what, and you, there's no way you would have anticipated something like that happening. My experience, one other small thing that I will say is that the East Coast media in the United States is far more aggressive, far more into investigative reporting, and far more likely to trap you than the West Coast media.
Do you feel they're more interested in what goes on the East Coast as well?
Just more aggressive?
No, but...
Oh, yes.
I mean, certainly when you read the New York Times, they're rarely examples from California.
Right.
You're just too far.
You know, it's interesting. For years, Physics Today was accused of being an East Coast publication, and we didn't have that mindset whatsoever. I mean, there's a sensitivity, especially back then, when I think it was more true back then, that there were more places of research. And just statistically, you were going to cover more things on the East Coast than on the West Coast. And it may come out differently now, but it was interesting. Wasn't our mindset, and it was a perception of our readers, I think.
I noticed it more, not so much in science, but in education issues, where they normally would call somebody at Harvard, Princeton, or Yale, rather than Caltech or Stanford. Or University of California, all these places. Or maybe it's the three-hour time zone.
Well, but you know, another thing is really an awful lot of media went to those schools, and they go to their home school. It's just a very inbred society. Yale, Princeton, and Harvard really do the sort of Eastern media.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.